from KQED.
KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. I'm Michael Krasny. For decades, people dubbed home voters have ruled California's housing market with a tight fist. Years of zoning and tax policies that favored single-family housing created a market that rewards the rich who can afford homes and punishes renters and young people. And the Bay Area is the epicenter of the crisis. That's according to New York Times reporter Connor Doherty, author of the new book Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. We'll talk with him about the book and about the Bay Area innovators battling to reverse the trends. Join us next after this news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Most Californians are well aware of the state's high housing costs, but few know the long, convoluted, and contentious history of policies that created what many call a crisis. In his book, Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America, New York Times reporter Connor Doherty takes a deep dive into how the Bay Area emerged as the epicenter of the housing debate. Doherty focuses on key players fighting for more housing, including a Catholic nun who has quietly amassed a portfolio of apartments for low-income people, a developer turned housing manufacturer, and an accidental activist who went from ranting on Twitter to running for office. And welcome, Connor Doherty. Good to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, as you point out in your book, and as we're unfortunately all too acutely well aware, we're at an inflection point, a severe crisis with housing. But take us back, because many people don't realize that the scarcity of housing really takes us back to World War II and housing policies, particularly in terms of exclusionist policies with all the obsession on single-family homes and exclusionist zoning and the like. Didn't quite work with market forces. It worked mainly, well, with politics and power.
So you can't separate politics and power from housing, I don't think. Land is this kind of shared resource and a lot of government control over it. But yeah, if you go read the stories of what the Bay Area and really America looked like after World War II, it sounds like today. Obviously, there's different reasons for it, but people are sleeping in their cars. There was an ad for someone could rent a chicken coop. There's a famous story of a couple in New York sleeping in a department store window to advertise their apartment search. So it was a really bad national housing shortage. And the reason was not totally dissimilar. Obviously, it's a little different, but there was the Long Depression. Nobody really built anything then. And then there was the war, which led to all this rationing. So finally, people come back, the economy's doing good, and they just go on this epic building boom that really brought us the modern suburbs. And I think like what I'm trying to ask at a very, very high level in this book is, if you think about America and why America is a rich or looks like a rich country, a rich society, not a society with a lot of rich people, but a society where you go, wow, that whole country looks more affluent than other countries. Housing is the singular symbol of that. You can go back as far as you want to go, at least a century or so, and people are talking about Americans' large homes. And then, of course, in the 50s and 60s, how many creature comforts they had in these homes.
And how many cars in their garage.
Exactly. Nixon famously went to Moscow and said, this ranch home is available to, they had a symposium kind of thing. And he said, this ranch house is available to a steelworker in Pittsburgh. And Nikita Khrushchev didn't believe him because that seemed impossible. So this has been, to some extent, a national cause that we are rich enough that anybody can live in a very comfortable and well-appointed home. That's no longer the case.
That is indeed no longer the case, and we have to build more housing, but there's no way to make that housing affordable for those who need it. I mean, that appears to be really the cul-de-sac that we're in, to put it bluntly. And I'm wondering also about the fact that the construction industry is really, as you point out in your book, far more efficient in building homes than it was, say, at the end of World War II.
It's not more efficient. Yes, exactly. So one of the big innovations that happened with the building of the post-war suburbs is Levittown. Obviously, Levitt gets all this credit, but a lot of builders around the country were using these same techniques. It was almost like how McDonald's became a thing, and then around the country, everybody emulated that kind of production line. So they started building homes with balloon frame construction, kind of laying them out like an assembly line. And that was a huge innovation. It really lowered the cost of homes. You could buy a suburban home for roughly what it costs to rent like a 2-bedroom at that time. I should note that there was huge government subsidies and all that, FHA backing, 30-year fixed mortgages, other things supporting that. But, you know, not unlike, let's say, solar batteries or something today, there was a lot of government support and then the kind of private sector layered on top of that. But if you look at the productivity rates for construction, they're not a whole lot better today than they were back then. Look at everything else we have, our phones, our, you know, how we shop. You know, the whole world has been digitized, roboticized. If you go to a factory now, all sorts of robot arms are doing things. So housing is not kept up. And so it is, that is another piece of this puzzle, which is how do we actually build a house for cheaper?
Well, as you point out, developers don't come along and build affordable housing in too many instances. In fact, they feel thwarted. And you go into that history as well. I mean, Prop 13 and EIRs and, you know, so many things that really contributed to environmental protests. But largely, in many ways, homeowners doing the fighting against, again, opening up and building more in their neighborhoods. It's a NIMBYism.
Totally. Well, I try to be sensitive to the history of this and sort of not. I know that the term NIMBY and this conversation can get very vilifying, if that's a word. But if you look at what happened in the Bay Area and a lot of other places, they were building freeways everywhere. They were there was a plan to obviously the Embarcadero Freeway became kind of a big kind of rallying point in San Francisco. They were going to build freeways over Golden Gate Park. They were going to fill in the bay. So there were a lot of reasons why people were saying, this is too much. We need to stop this. And I think all those fights were ultimately good. The question is, did they backlash so much so that it's impossible to even build housing where it's supposed to go? You know, there were some famous fights in Marin County where they said, well, we don't want housing on the Headlands or other places, which I think most people around here would say that seems like a good decision. But then, you know, somebody tries to build like a, you know, 3-story thing in San Rafael and people flip out. And that starts to seem a little like that's not what we mean when we say leaving open space or.
On the other hand, they were building where places were just more susceptible to wildfires. And, you know, we have that whole problem upon us now as well. But I want to get to really what's at the heart of your book, which are the stories of innovators who have sort of come up against the kind of problems we're talking about here. Although I think NIMBYism does play a big role. There's simply no two ways about it. Anti-growth and all of that has been going on since the 70s, as you point out, and so-called home voters have been against development. It's not to cast aspersions. It's not, as you say, to be nasty about it. But there's also a supply problem. There's a labor problem. I mean, all of these things play into the whole
picture. Well, as I say in the book, everything got horrible at once, and now
it's a perfect storm.
Yes,
but let's get to some of the stories. You have this kaleidoscope of portraits of people who are really working on housing problems, and some of these stories are inspiring. They're not necessarily panaceas by any stretch, but they're certainly stories that captured my attention, and I think will our listeners. And let's start with Sonia Trauss, a name that's not unfamiliar to many of our listeners who ran for supervisor in San Francisco. But before we start with Sonia, let's start where you start, with actually city manager of Lafayette, Steve Falk, who had the occasion of meeting Sonia Trauss, and his life was changed. He went from being a city manager trying to essentially make more housing to realizing that there were too many problems with affordable housing and problems that he had to maybe take stock of.
Totally. So I really appreciate you saying about that, the kaleidoscope, because that's really what I tried to do. I thought, let's just see a lot of different people working on this problem in the way that they know how and the way that makes sense for them. So Steve Falk was the city manager of Lafayette, and there was this plot of land in Lafayette that had always been zoned for high-density apartments. A lot of people didn't know this. They never.
This is over on Deer Hill Road.
Yes, and they never. It, you know what? And some of the people from Lafayette have complained to me after my story. I should know it. It is not the best place for housing, but the city, in all its wisdom, zoned it there. So that was their corporate decision, or that was their civic decision. I know that the people who moved there kind of inherited that decision, but that's kind of what happens when you move somewhere. You inherit a rich history that has a lot of things in it, decisions that were made about the trajectory of the place that are before you. Anyway, so this old guy owned it, never thought he'd do anything with it. He dies. Pretty quickly, a developer proposes this giant apartment complex on it, and people flip out. a lot of people thought it was like open space. They sure never thought it was zoned for, you know, high density apartments. So Steve goes to the developer. I mean, people freak. The meetings are just absolute. Someone says this is going to allow more crime to be committed. I mean, people were just outraged. And so Steve goes and says, look, let's and I should note, Steve was very in favor of building high density housing right next to BART. This is about a mile away from BART. And he says to the developer, like, can we just make some sort of deal? The developer, by the way, I should note, the developer had threatened to sue them. And so Steve sort of knew he was legally boxed in.
This is Dennis O'Brien, who, yes. I don't want to get too ahead of your story here, but winds up paying for both sides. But
yes, it was a
hilarious story.
When I started, it was funny, I said that to Dennis, and he goes, well, it might be hilarious to you. What happens is they basically go and they have this meeting where they say, like, can we work something out? And Dennis, this will be important to the story, Dennis voluntarily submits a new application for a new project. So now, 4 years later, it's now been 4 years, Steve's getting – the council is on the cusp of approving this new 44 single-family home project. And they had added a dog park. They'd moved an intersection in a different way so that it would aim traffic out of the development. Anyway, they did all these things to placate people. Sonia, who I should note was looking heavily for attention at this time, went and sued Lafayette under this thing called the Housing Accountability Act, which hilariously Jerry Brown passed. I can find almost no record of its passage in 1982. California governors often say, I sign 1,000 bills a year and you don't hear about most of them. This is like one of those, like 999 or whatever. So Sonia goes and basically decides she's going to sue Lafayette on behalf of Dennis O'Brien's old project, essentially suing him on behalf of him. And Dennis is like, I don't want you to sue them. It was this bizarre situation. So Sonia, they ended up settling. And then what happens is Dennis O'Brien has to pay her legal fees. So he's now paying to settle the case that is being argued the other way that he had threatened to file the same lawsuit that Sonia had, and now he's basically paying to defend.
And Steve Falk becomes a convert, sort of, to Sonia's way of seeing things. And Sonia becomes not only the leader of YIMBYism, but turns YIMBYism into really an international phenomenon.
Well, what's really – yes, totally. What's really crazy about this story is that – just to finish the Lafayette story – is that the city then had a referendum to get rid of the 44 homes. That passed, and then Dennis O'Brien shows back up and says, okay, fine, I'm going to do the 315, which you promised me I could do. That's where it stands today. About the international phenomenon thing, I should say, I wrote an article about Sonia for the New York Times about four years ago. After it ran, someone invited me to a YIMBY conference in Boulder, Colorado. And I thought, this is too weird. I'm going to go. And I was scared I was going to like waste the New York Times' money. So I found another story in Boulder because I was like, I was convinced the conference would be like four people in a bar or something. I go there. It's like 200 people. The mayor of Boulder is there. The mayor of Sitka, Alaska was there, which I was like, what? Two women had flown in. Two planners had flown in from Brisbane, Australia. It was crazy. And then, of course, all the places you would expect, Seattle, Austin, Portland, Minneapolis, Boston, expensive kind of, for lack of a better term, knowledge centers, places that are, let's call them Bay Area-like, where people work with their minds principally. And they were all there talking about housing, and it was this surreal scene. And now this YIMBY Town thing is like an annual event. I think the fourth one is in Portland later this year.
We're talking to Connor Doherty, and he's a reporter in the New York Times, author of Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. He'll be appearing, by the way, at Green Apple Books tonight at 7:30 p.m. and tomorrow at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park at 7:30 p.m. Let's talk about somebody else who you profile here. We're talking about actually a nun by the name of Christina Helsley, who you write about and provide a narrative and a story for. This goes all on in Redwood City, and she starts buying up apartment complexes, affordable complexes, I mean, building a portfolio.
Yeah, so one of the really amazing things about following a story for 3 years is I wrote the book in just a few months, but I had done the reporting over a very long period of time. And all these things happen that you could have never predicted when you started following it. One is Steve Falk quit in a huff. When I met Steve Falk, he was like fighting Sonia. 3 years later, he's like, I quit. I'm so mad about this density. Sister Christina was somebody who had an investor. There was this big apartment building across from her nonprofit called the St. Francis Center, and an investor came in. They bought it, evicted everyone. They had a huge protest. Long story short, she spent a year and a half hustling all these donations from John Sobrato, so obviously very wealthy Silicon Valley developer. It's now and they bought it back from the investor and then made it deed-restricted affordable housing. What I thought was fascinating about this story, just narratively, I mean, it was just like a gift to me, is as a reporter, you know, you just sometimes you get these gems and they're handed to you and you're like, I can't believe this is real. And she essentially is solving for morality. You know, she's got these very deep principles that she feels about, you know, obviously her faith, but also housing. And when you would read the kind of prospectuses and things that the investor put out for this building, they would talk about their return as if it was like a law of nature, you know, as if like some sort of law of physics would be violated if they didn't make X money on it. So then she buys it back and it has now been refilled with people who are higher income. She could actually save a bunch of money if she had evicted them all, because there's a state program that would remit to her a bunch of property taxes, which would have amounted to about $1 million if she got rid of the higher end tenants. But she refused because she's got this like thou shalt not evict kind of, you know, law she lives by. And what I thought was so, I mean, I'm not trying to say the housing problem is going to be solved by, you know, nuns or anything, but I just thought it was such a poignant example of somebody who's using morality as their guide versus someone who's using pure return as their guide. I mean, I hope the world finds a middle place, but it was still so striking.
You have these striking stories, and there are stories of, again, I use the word innovators. And yet, if there's going to be any solution to housing, I think you point out the only solutions that seem to come down the pike are mixed solutions, subsidies and rent control or both, and not necessarily the kind of things that are all this unusual or all this outlier kind of stuff you're talking about.
Well, I think the message I'm trying to send with the book is that all these people are working on this problem. You know, when I started the book, I will say this. I was out selling the book, and some of the publishers I talked to were more interested in sort of like a policy book that would look at this problem and kind of talk about it and, you know, how did it happen and stuff like that. And I knew intuitively that this problem was going to be so much worse by the time the book came out. And in my mind, I thought, I want to show people working on this problem because, you know, as I say in the book, there was people started writing books about this problem. In 1979 is the first book I can find on it. So this...
We had Matt Desmond on. I know you're familiar with his work.
Yes, he blurbed the book. So
that's right.
Yeah. I consider him a friend. So yes, no, it was huge. So anyway, what I'm saying is that this problem has been identified for quite some time. And so the question becomes, why has it not been solved? And let's watch people try to solve it and the insane hurdles they have to overcome, and that alone should show us why this is ultimately a political problem, not an economics problem.
It's also a sociological problem, though, isn't it?
Totally. I mean, absolutely it's a sociological problem. I think that I was saying last night, I was at an event, and I said to someone, look, I think that even the most, I mean, maybe not the most, but I think that a person who really did not want a high-density thing next to their single-family home or something, if you really guaranteed them that the Bay Area's housing crisis would start to be solved and that they would see less homelessness on the streets and less suffering, they would make that sacrifice. But it's hard because that's not going to happen, right? It's this problem that a million people have to solve in little steps. It's like recycling or something. And you know, one of these little drip things that we all have to participate in, but we can never really see the fruits of our action. And I think that makes it really hard.
Well, it's a good time to invite our listeners to weigh in here. And if you've just joined us, Connor Doherty is with us. Journalist Connor Doherty has written about fighting for housing in the Bay Area and beyond, and makes the point, in fact, that what's going on in the Bay Area, though it may be more dysfunctional than just about anywhere else, I think you do make that point, Connor, it's nevertheless perhaps microscopically representative of what's going on throughout the country in so many ways, and we can talk about that with you as well. That is how much the Bay Area mirrors what's going on nationally. If you'd like to join us, I invite you to do that now. You can join us at our toll-free number. The number to call, 866-733-6786, and we do welcome your calls. Any questions or comments you might have, please feel free to join us now again at 866-733-6786. This is all in the wake, of course, here in California of SB 50 going down, Scott Wiener's proposal about housing expansion, and I'd like to hear from you, our listeners. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments to forum@kqed.org. John writes, I look forward to reading Connor Doherty's book. I'm curious if he examines the racial equity and history aspect of today's housing crisis. Well, you do get into it.
Yes, so anybody who has driven on the 24 freeway to Lafayette past my neighborhood of Rockridge is maybe unbeknownst to them driving on the William Byron Rumford freeway. William Byron Rumford is an overlooked but incredibly important California legislator. He was the first black person elected to state office from Northern California. And he passed a law called the Rumford Act in, I think, 1963. And this predated, I mean, this really was an example of California leading the nation. It predated civil rights by 5 years. And it was also much more effective than the National Fair Housing Act, because they did set up this body to really enforce it. And it was going quite well. This led to an incredibly ugly period of California history that we don't talk about very much. There was a backlash called Prop 14. By the way, the initiative system provides lots of rollicking battles for this book. And what happened was, they essentially, the Real Estate Realtors Association wanted to, they essentially put an initiative on that would repeal this fair housing law, which basically said you cannot rent, or you cannot refuse to rent or sell housing to someone based on their race. And they put on an initiative to not only repeal this, but to encode in the state constitution that you could discriminate, essentially a statewide segregation bill. It passed overwhelmingly. It was ultimately shot down by the California Supreme Court due to the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. But it was a brutally ugly period in and so that was just one story that I thought was very emblematic of I mean, obviously FHA, redlining, all that stuff's in the book too. But I thought this one particular battle was really telling to me for two reasons. One, because it passed so overwhelmingly. But two, in the same election, Lyndon Johnson, who kind of represented liberalism, was elected president. Reelected. So anyway.
Well, we're going to get our listeners involved in this discussion with Connor Doherty. Again, his new book is called Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. The fight is ongoing. There's certainly a lot of talk about more Section 8 rental vouchers. There are a lot of things we can touch on that we haven't even touched on. But the state needs 3.5 million by 2025, as many of you know. And that's all kinds of housing, three times what's presently being built. Change is a necessity here. Income inequality is really a great part of it. We'll hear from you when we return. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Connor Doherty of the New York Times, who has written a book called Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. And he'll be appearing tonight at Green Apple Books here in San Francisco at 7:30, and tomorrow at Kepler's Books in Menlo Park at 7:30. And we're going to go right to your calls, but I ought to mention there are a lot of stories in here that really are worth reading. There's a developer who's building houses on an assembly line. There's a 15-year-old kid who's organizing apartment complexes in Redwood City. There's also a prefab homes builder and developer by the name of Rick Holiday. I mean, much to read and much to learn about in this book. But let me just speak about an optimistic note from not only the stories of the innovators that you write about, but you went to a lot of city meetings, and there's a lot of activism in city meetings. There's a lot of activism from people who really have a good stake in the housing crisis.
Totally.
And creative stuff coming out.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this housing fight in the Bay Area is extremely contentious. But we got to remember that most people don't show up. And I hope that this book is kind of a celebration of people who show up, whatever their policy they're pushing for, whatever their preferred outcome. Sometimes they're going to be fighting with someone else, you know, who has a different policy desire. But, you know, you see these people, these 25-year-olds, these YIMBYs going to city meetings, planning meetings. I mean, when I was 25, I was not doing that. And you see 15-year-old girls, like I said, organizing apartment complexes. It takes a lot for people to show up. And I think that we should absolutely be celebrating it, just that general fact, because I think apathy is the real enemy here.
Let me go to our callers, and let me begin, Kristen, with you. Kristen, you're on. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I wanted to make the point, so I was born and raised here, and I actually inherited property that's under Prop 13, so I actually inherit the tax basis for that. But even with that, I can't actually afford to build a home, including the two ADUs that I would like to build in order to provide housing for others. And unfortunately, I'm sort of at a dead end now.
Connor, want to comment?
So, what you're saying is that you think the construction price for the ADU is too high. Is that what you're saying?
I think that's what you're saying, isn't it, Kristen?
Yeah.
Kristen, are you there?
Oh, yes. Sorry. Not just the construction prices, but also the restrictions from local government as well for requiring many things.
Yes. So, I mean, this is something that, you know, the book is obviously talks a lot about regulation. The state just passed a slew of ADU bills, and I have a feeling that this will be rectified pretty quickly. If it isn't, then I have to wonder what they were doing because there were so many new ADU bills. If I were you, I would, I don't know, try to figure out. I mean, the permit situation is moving so fast now that it's hard to know exactly what's going on, but it should be getting profoundly easier. Momentarily.
I think he's telling you there's hope up ahead, Kristen, and good luck to you. Thank you for the call. Let me get another caller on, and that's Andrew. Good morning.
Hey there. Say, I was calling to ask the author if he has heard any interesting ideas about changing areas like El Camino Real and San Mateo, where there's a lot of underutilized, like, one-story retail and, let's just say, auto sales type establishments that could be high density housing.
It's a good question, Andrew.
Like we're trying to build housing in. Go ahead.
Excuse me. No, I think it's a good question, important question. I'm just looking at a comment or a dovetailing question from Paul who says only 17% of the Bay Area is actually built on. Over 80% is open space. Can't we extend urban limit lines to increase the supply of buildable land for low income housing?
So those are two separate questions, right? So one of the callers is asking about doing more high-intensity use along a transit corridor, and the other is saying, can we open up virgin land, right? We'll probably have to do a little bit of both, though obviously the values of this place are trying to preserve open space, and I think we should – I think that's a value we should continue to hold dear.
We need some kind of comprehensive plan and a plan that's going to work.
Yeah, and what I think we also need, and this is what I'm trying to push, is a plan that we stick to. I mean, the problem with some of these zoning plans is they come up with these big plans and everyone participates in them and they take years to do, which they should. But then when they're done, everyone still fights every project as a one-off. Like we should have a big righteous fight over the rules and the plan and then more or less stick to it.
Let me thank Andrew for his call. Maya writes, I hear you supported the now three times defeated SB 50 bill. Do you believe the bill will help the speculation crisis in Oakland?
So I did not support it. I wrote numerous articles about it. I was a journalist. I don't really get into a position of like supporting or not supporting bills. That said, I'm happy. I don't think it betrays any objectivity to say somebody has to come up with some sort of bill that will radically increase the supply of housing. Where and how that's done is obviously up to democracy. But this was the most, you know, this was the most significant bill to come on that. It failed. It failed with a very broad and diverse coalition of single-family homeowners and renters worried about gentrification. So they're going to have to address that. If they come out with a bill that is much more amenable to people and still comes out, you know, still starts to ultimately solve the problem. I would just say that's the system working, not the system failing. So at the moments after SB 50 failed, Toni Atkins went straight to her, you know, dais or whatever, and said, we're going to vowed to pass a new housing production bill this year. So I think we will be hearing much, much, much more about this.
You point out something interesting, though, about Senator Scott Wiener. Either, I think I'm paraphrasing what you write here, but either he's the most outspoken proponent for affordable housing, which he certainly appears to be, or he's a big developer shill, which is what the counter argument goes in terms of attacking him and attacking his motives.
Well, so we have tied our affordable housing and market rate housing systems together. That's a legacy that we inherited. There's a lot of legacies we've inherited in this book, and, you know, we should change some of them, but we also have to live with some of them. We use inclusionary zoning to try to build affordable housing within market rate, i.e., if the market rate doesn't get built, the affordable units are not built. And even when we're building 100% affordable housing, the everything besides the financing mechanism is more or less the same. There are some variations, but generally speaking, you have to go through the same hurdles. So for better or for worse, if we want to make it easier to build affordable housing, we're going to probably have to make it easier to build market rate housing as well. I know a lot of people are only hearing that, and I don't really know what to say about it other than, I mean, if you wanted to try to solve this problem in a much more kind of full frontal socialist type way, where you would create social housing and all these things at scale, I mean, obviously, people should be doing that at small scale all the time and experimenting like crazy. You would probably need some sort of gigantic national housing program that would have like a T after it, a T for trillion.
Here's a tweet from Corrine who says, let's not forget more housing needs infrastructure as well. Our aging roadways, schools, et cetera, were never built to accommodate the number of people they now serve. Cities like San Jose focused on jobs without the housing and infrastructure. Fair point, and more of your calls. Dale. Join us. You're on, Dale.
Hello.
Hi.
Okay. Hello?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Yes. I was just curious, having been evicted in San Francisco a few years back from Outside Money, an LLC backed by foreign money, I'm just curious how much, I know there's a lot of vacant property and how much we could control it by market forces. You know, there's like investors pouring in here to park money in San Francisco. And perhaps I've heard the Southwest and other vast tracts where people bundled mortgages together to make it an investment tool. If we didn't made housing less liquid that way, where it's kind of geared more towards people being in housing and less of a purely third-party investment device.
Yeah. Connor Doherty, what do you think?
Yes. So this is a huge issue. In fact, me and my colleague Ben Castleman at the Times have been doing a ton of stuff about the absolute flood of investor money in, this is my sort of next topic for the next year, into real estate. We've seen this all around the place. The Zillow now has this.
I hope you're going to dig deep. It's a lot of digging to do.
Yes. But I will say, investors go, so what investors are trying to do is profit off of like an arbitrage opportunity. They see something that is worth less than they think that they can make it, and so then they try to do it. I think that scarcity is the underlying disease there. They are plowing into this housing because they see a large profit opportunity because, you know, scarcity is giving them that opportunity. On top of that, we want... Housing is a wealth-building mechanism. Whether or not that's a good idea, it is now something we have. It's very hard to take that away.
It's fait accompli.
Exactly. Well, and also, I mean, if you look at Bernie Sanders' housing plan, Bernie Sanders, all the major Democratic presidential candidates have put out a housing plan. Bernie Sanders, it can't decide. It's. I mean, there are lots of things I like about the plan, but one thing that I think is very vexing about it is it can't decide what it wants to be. Sometimes it wants to help people build wealth through housing, and sometimes it wants to reduce the profit motive amongst developers. And I think ideologically that's something a lot of people feel, right? That's a feeling that is pervasive in America. But I think it's really hard to do that because I think we just have to kind of I understand what you're saying, and I think the LLC thing is a huge problem. I guess all I can say is that people need to experiment with it. In Vancouver, they've done a bunch of empty homes taxes, stuff like that. I mean, there are plenty of cities around the world that are playing with this, and we should obviously look to them for guidance.
And let me thank Dale for his call and go right to another caller. And that's you, Justin, from Pleasanton. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I would like to kind of push back a little bit. I don't deny that there is a shortage of housing, but there are, I think it's misrepresented and mischaracterized, and there are just too many things that don't add up. Namely, or notably, California's population has been decreasing, not increasing. We're at 39.5 million right now. We were at, I think, 37.5 million as long as 10 years ago. Even as recent as 5 years ago, housing wasn't even a discussion on the table. So then, you know, what else is going on here? When you look deeper into it, you'll find that there are just a lot of things unaccounted for in our census, like the number, like the millions of H-1B visa workers that are living in the Bay Area. These people are not accounted for in our census. We have foreign investors buying hundreds of billions, with a B, dollars worth of property throughout the state of California. This also became an issue in Canada, where the Canadian government had to stop a 15% tax on foreign property buyers. So at a time when Americans are being displaced, I just think that they're losing properties to external forces. And I'll listen off the air. Thank you.
All right, Justin, thank you for that question. In fact, a listener named Laura says, please ask your guest to talk about why more people do not leave California when they cannot find affordable housing.
So California's population is, Justin is absolutely right. So it's not falling, but it's barely growing because more people move out than in. More people have moved out of California than in since about the 90s. There are some variations here and there. These are all the people you hear about going to Texas and whatever.
Montana.
Yes, exactly. Well, the biggest destinations are like Phoenix and Dallas. But anyway, I'm sure there are some Montanans in there too. So so housing may not have been in the conversation 5 years ago, but it has been an issue in California for longer than I've been alive, and I'm 42. That, like I said, there were books, people were writing about this huge housing insecurity problem, in the late 70s. So mid 70s, because I was born in the late 70s. But anyway, so I think that foreign capital into housing is something we should absolutely look at. I do not think that that is primarily the problem, but it is absolutely part of the problem. One of the things I say that's bad about – that's difficult about the housing conversation is that everyone's like right. People who say that we didn't build enough housing are right. People who say that tenants have no protection are right. People who say Airbnb is taking some units off the market for hotels instead of people living in them, they're right. The question is so, and one of the difficulties about the policy conversation is that if you can point to something that is not like completely irrational, that can be your, you can sort of create a reality in which that is the only and primarily the problem. I don't think foreign investors are primarily the problem, though they absolutely are in Vancouver, where I went, Justin alluded to. But like I said in the previous question, there's a lot of models here, London, Sydney, Vancouver. To some extent, I think New York played with this for foreign buyer taxes. I don't think you can exactly prevent a foreigner from, without changing the United States law, housing, but you could certainly start passing vacant home taxes and things like that.
Ron wants to know, what about the super rich companies working on this problem, both for their employees as well as the Bay Area? Well, some of them are. Google has moved forward a lot.
Yeah. So one thing I think that we need to kind of address here, and Justin was kind of talking about this, is it is probably true that there are parts of California where there's lots of empty homes, kind of like he was alluding to. But that's not where the jobs are, right? And, I will hear people say, this is very frequently people say this, why can't they just move the jobs out there? I don't have an answer to that, but I can tell you, I do have an answer to that, which is that the economy very rarely works that way. Companies tend to cluster. We're sitting here in a very tall building in a commercial center, and people locate near it because they want to be near it. But
remember, there was some talk about moving tech to Detroit because the housing costs were so inexpensive.
But that's
there.
Not yeah, exactly.
It's not going to happen.
Well, that's just not how the economy works. Things tend to agglomerate. Without getting too deep into it. Anyway, so my point is that a lot of Bay Area cities, San Francisco as well, have added a ton of jobs without housing. The decisions to add those jobs were affirmative decisions that their city councils made. Palo Alto has something like 4 jobs per housing unit. Those jobs were, at least in some fashion or form, invited there by that government, by that citizenry over many, many, many years. And now they have a housing problem. But I don't think you can – I don't think you can just say, I didn't know these jobs were coming because, I mean, we built a Salesforce tower. They built the Apple spaceship. You know, it's pretty obvious that the jobs are growing, and it's pretty obvious that cities are not terribly unhappy about that. Or, you know, and so now I think that – I think it's disingenuous to say we didn't want all this growth when you're like, well, you didn't want housing growth, but you sure didn't seem to care when they wanted to build, you know, a gigantic – skyscraper or, you know, a donut Apple headquarters or whatever, you know?
Well, it meant a lot more revenue for the cities.
Well, but, you know, I'm just saying, you know, that comes with responsibility. It is – we could get into a whole thing about Prop 13 and all these things, but I'm just saying that our governments have –
You're kind of implying the cities weren't necessarily preparing enough or they weren't doing it.
Well, I'm saying that they made affirmative decisions in a public process in all the same ways they make decisions about housing to add jobs. There's a famous video you can go find of Steve Jobs trying to sort of sell the Cupertino City Council on the spaceship. And they ask about housing and stuff. I don't know where that conversation went. But aside from asking the question, they don't seem to have done much about it. So I think it's wrong for us to act as if this just like accidentally happened.
Again, we're talking to Connor Doherty, who is a reporter for The New York Times and who has written a book called Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. And here's Tom. Tom, join us.
Yes, hi. Two things. Firstly, I'd like to know what other secondary cities in the East Bay, Marin Peninsula are doing about building housing. Historically, a lot of them have said, well, go build it in Oakland or whatever, affordable housing. And, for example, Pleasanton was sued by Jerry Brown and then nothing after that. And then my second question, also important, and your guests might not know about this, but while the historians have saved a lot of buildings in downtown Oakland, like the Fox Theater and the Rotunda Building, both in conjunction with developer Phil Tagami, they have also prevented a lot of building and killed a lot of projects for buildings that are old but not historic.
Well, actually, Connor's roots are here in San Francisco, but he lives in Oakland now. I'd like you to address that second question. But the first, can you give us sort of a reporter's view of what's being done in the Bay Area that is, I mean, aside from the stories you have to tell of individuals? So,
I try not to get into anyone. So I don't know too much about the Pleasanton thing. I'm vaguely aware of it.
You mean about Tagami?
I'm sorry. He asked about Pleasanton and suing Marin and Pleasanton. Anyway, Gavin Newsom has made a big deal of Huntington Beach. Obviously, the legal system is going to be part of this. Jerry Brown signed the Housing Accountability Act in 82. So clearly, the idea that you might need courts to force cities to build housing has been on the table for quite some time. But just philosophically, I will say, when we get into all these one-off battles, that's the problem. Like, should we have a one-off battle about every single building we build, or we should just have a general plan and more or less stick to it? I'm not saying there shouldn't be any input. But, okay, regarding Oakland, I do not know much about that, but I will say this. A lot of people benefit from the current system. It wouldn't be hard to change if they didn't. And it is I don't really explore this in the book, but it is absolutely true, and I'm not saying this applies to necessarily to this particular person, that there are certain developers who are really good at getting developments built in the Bay Area. They typically are from here, they don't want that. This system might not be working for most people, but it is working for them too. And what I think sometimes we kind of forget is that, you know, there are, well, like I said, just there are people benefiting from this system, and they're going to fight really, really, really hard not to change it. And those people will sometimes be single family homeowners, but they will also sometimes be developers who basically don't want competition.
Let me thank the caller. We do have a crisis also in terms of labor now, don't we?
Huge crisis. And, you know, this dovetails with like a many million different issues, which is that, you know, we do not do the trades nearly as well as we should in this country. I thought that the manufactured housing thing, even though there's probably going to be a big union fight over that, or there already are a few, I thought that that was a really interesting window into what the future of housing and construction might be. But yeah, after the Great Recession, I mean, it cannot be overstated how bad the Great Recession was for construction industries. Companies were laying off 90% of their people, you know, and skilled tradesmen, those who were great tradespeople, but were, and they basically just like left the industry. And so ultimately what happened is we did not have a workforce anymore to build housing.
You're listening to Forum, and we're talking about the Bay Area housing crisis with New York Times reporter Connor Doherty. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support KQED, we urge you to go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me go to a comment from Mike, who says, we work to maintain prices for consumer goods. How can a market allow itself to be priced beyond people's ability to pay? You have to provide housing people can afford. Why can't a housing market be regulated or regulate itself for its own survival? Well, I guess it gets into rent control, whether it works or not.
I don't know if he's talking about rent control or if he's talking about why can't we build enough that the price would regulate itself. I guess the answer is because the government – I mean, the government is really involved in housing. I always joke to people like you can't just like go – if they tell you not to do something – businesses break rules all the time, right? And sometimes they break rules, get caught, and then keep breaking them and no one notices. It is really hard to just go build a building somewhere. I mean, real estate is this highly regulated industry. And there was actually a famous case a couple of years ago where someone did actually build an extra floor without telling anyone. And I thought that was hilarious because it was like the exception, not the rule. But, you know, it is a finite – real estate is not the same as any other market, but it does have market properties. And right now we're not letting it satisfy the housing needs.
I was thinking of rent control, though, because when you're thinking about the consumer market, it does play an enormous integral role. And I wonder to what extent rent control really fits into the whole picture that you've provided for us in your book.
Yeah. So rent control is something that a lot of economists are not a fan of. That's because economists, even quite liberal economists, do not like price controls generally. That does not mean they're against subsidization schemes or anything to make the price more that consumers can bear it, but they don't like the actual idea of price controls because it starts to mess up the market and create all these skewed incentives. Here's what I would say about that. The optimal way an economist would tell you to solve like the problem with rising rents is some sort of grand tax scheme like Cory Booker had actually proposed in his housing plan. I think that that probably would be a smarter way of solving it, but we're nowhere near that. People are suffering now. If someone wants to go put that plan on the table and show a really great funding mechanism for it, that's then a serious conversation. But it's a little disingenuous for economists to say like, oh, this is suboptimal, like some dreamy program that we might have should be the pro. You know, like that's crazy. I mean, I don't get me wrong. It's great for academic journals, but it's not great for people suffering.
And here's Nadja. Nadja, join us. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. I am currently in an apartment where the rent just went up $150, and it's put me right at the edge of being able to afford it. But I've lived here almost 30 years, so when I get my money back, it's not going to be enough for me to move into another place. And I'm just wondering, I went to Section 8 to see about affordable housing and help. They basically told me that there were other people who really needed a house and I had one, and I'm like, I'm not going to have it for long. And the places that said they would accept help from Section 8 from me, just me. So if I move out, there's still not another apartment available because of that. And I know other people in this area who are having the same problem.
Yeah, I alluded earlier, Connor, to the Section 8 vouchers. You want to comment on that from Nadja's question?
Yes. I mean, this is a huge – this is where, unfortunately, we have to get into the federal government. It's a huge problem. We do not have enough money for Section 8 vouchers. We should have lots more. I don't really know what to say about that other than
– need the government.
Call your representative, you know. But, I mean, you know, I talked about the federal role in housing – a fair amount in the book, but I didn't really dwell on it. And I think that it is – when people say the federal government has abdicated its role in housing, they are absolutely correct. I mean, HUD used to give more money in nominal dollars to San Francisco, to say nothing of inflation and population growth.
Can we talk plainly here about how much more difficult it's been under Trump? You don't have to be partisan.
No. I mean, it actually hasn't changed that much. I mean, it's,
really?
Well, so the one thing he did that was recent, it hasn't happened yet, and it may not, but he changed a discrimination rule that Obama had. Whether or not that goes through is up to, there'll be months before we figure that out. Okay, so one thing that did happen, this was, I wouldn't quite call it by accident, but it's when they cut the tax rate, when they slashed corporate taxes, this gets somewhat complicated, but without getting too deep into it, they essentially simultaneously slashed funding for affordable housing.
That's right.
And that it was a huge problem. Although I will say, this is actually a glimmer of hope. Orrin Hatch and Maria Cantwell, Democrat and Republican, quickly came up with a bill to restore it. And so I thought, well, at least this is a bipartisan issue.
Connor, good to have you with us. Congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for being part of this program.
Thank you so much.
Connor Daugherty, reporter of New York Times, author of Golden Gates, Fighting for Housing in America. He'll appear at Green Apple Books tonight at 7:30 p.m. and tomorrow at Kepler's Books at Menlo Park, also at 7:30 p.m. And you can, in fact, continue this discussion online by going to our website, kqed.org/forum. I would not discourage that, and I would encourage you, in fact, to join us for another hour. We're going to talk with a linguistic scholar all about the history of the pronoun use of they, beyond he and she. Has the time come? Well, many people feel it has, but it's got a long history. That's next. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.